Is it time for a podcast already?
Check 1-2, check 1-2, check 1-2, check 1-2.
I go to your seat, lady, cause this one's a screamer!
I didn't know that.
Everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Garlic Jar Podcast Show. On tonight's episode, we have a bunch of questions from you, our listeners, that you guys hit up Sean with for like questions to be answered in our Q&A session part of his series. So tonight with me, I have Maddie and Sean, of course.
What's up, everybody?
How you doing, everybody?
All right. So Sean's got a bunch of questions for us. And I think we're ready, right? I think you've been preparing for a while.
Yeah, a lot of questions, and they're just great questions. I mean, you guys got a lot of smart listeners, I'll tell you that. But we just I haven't had a chance to, you know, in any of the episodes to get to these questions, so they've been building up. And I got like 30-some here. And then there's another probably dozen for Nate the Great, but he's not going to be with us tonight. He's, you know, little man's back to school, yeah. So he'll answer them in another podcast.
Well, I was going to say, we
got
to make sure we reserve a time slot for him to come back, because, like I said, our door is always open to Nate. Nate was a good kid to have on. You know, that was just a fun episode all around, you know?
Yeah, he did a great job. He really did. And there's a question. Scott Hopkins asked a question regarding Martin Luther King in the autopsy, a potential second autopsy. So I just want to tell Hopkins that Nate's doing the research on that, so wow, he'll have an answer for him next time. Yeah,
that's pretty cool. Now, is Nate doing something like that for school? Like, is that a project?
No. This is all separate. He's just interested in, you know, Martin Luther King and
that's awesome.
You know, the Kennedys even and stuff. So
great.
Pretty good for a kid 11 years old. You know, I was still playing with Star Wars guys.
Always good 11, to be curious.
Well, Sean, we don't want to hold you up any longer. I mean, we really want to go into this episode.
Okay, well,
so
let's get at it, and then I'll ask these questions as they're written in here, and then you guys could add after, you know, I'll answer them, and then you guys want to add anything?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Well, the first one's actually addressed to me and Nate, but I'll answer my part, and Nate could answer his answer later. But this is from Pilchy, from Mike Pilch. Aww. He says, to Nate and Sean, he said, guys, keep up the good work. He says, why do you think some of RFK's kids support the release of Sirhan Sirhan, and some are against it, and some just stay quiet on the matter? Well, that's a real good question. You know, and the thing is, you know, this is why I got upset at the last episode, and I was talking about those creatures that were hammering the Kennedy kids. I mean, you know, they're going to grieve different ways. So RFK Jr., you know, he looked at the evidence. He took the time to look at the evidence and see Sirhan is innocent. Now, Joe, the grandson, Joe, you know, he's against Sirhan's release. So I'm not going to sit here and criticize him, you know, because, you know, this their grieving process. And then some of the Kennedys wanted to stay quiet. And you also have to realize that, you know, a family like that, that's basically like American royalty. I mean, they're just going to, you know, they're going to have to, like, let's go back to when, like, RFK got criticized because he stayed quiet on the Warren Commission. Like, he kind of handily, like, just endorsed the Warren Commission. And you know, even though we know now that he didn't believe in the Warren Commission, and but he wanted the office of the presidency to reopen an investigation. But he didn't come out publicly and say that because, you know, there was a lot of reasons behind the scenes that he didn't want to do that. So, there's just different reasons why the kids, you know, some stay quiet, some are against it. But, you know, just a story on RFK, like we know now that him and Jackie reached out to Nikita Khrushchev shortly after, you know, JFK was assassinated. And it was true, a guy by the name of Walton, who was, I believe he was like an international arts dealer, and he was a friend of the family's, and they got the message to Khrushchev that, you know, if we know that, you know, the communists weren't behind this, we know it wasn't a lone gunman, and we know it was a domestic, you know, right-wing group within the United States, and he says, we just want you to know, meaning, you know, Nikita Khrushchev, that, you know, we know Lyndon Johnson is going to reverse all of JFK's policies, and we know the one thing is that he, you know, he's not going to be the search for peace like JFK was. So if you could just hold the fort and not provoke a nuclear war, you know, then RFK said, you know, when I'm president, he said, we could continue the quest for peace that, you know, JFK and Nikita Khrushchev has had after the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know. And at the same time he was sending this message, he was publicly saying, you know, nothing against the Warren Commission,
right?
You know, because he didn't feel that, you know, there was any advantage to doing that, because he didn't feel any investigation, you know, would work until he was president. So, you know, that's why I think there's different, you know, the kids react. Some of them just stay quiet. RFK Jr., though, I give him the, you know, he had a lot of guts to actually sit down, and it's got to be hard. He has been told this guy for 50 years has killed his father. And then he comes out, you know, he looks at the evidence and he says he's innocent, and, you know, he comes out and you know, he's for his release. So that's a really good question from Pilch.
From Mike, yeah.
Yeah, really good. You know, but I don't know if you guys have anything to add, but like I said, to just be bashing the kids, you know, like they're gonna grieve different ways, and what they say in public, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to criticize them.
Yeah, that's something that I would have wanted to come back to and just circle around, because obviously everybody knows that what's happening there. When you refer to them as these creatures that come out,
mm-hmm.
these are your typical internet trolls. And you know what? I really think that, like, if you read a lot of that information that they're trying to post, they're really trying to stir the pot. But yeah, I mean, just so everybody knows, I mean, this is what internet trolls do. You know, they try to make they try to make a little noise, and it gets everybody rattled.
Yeah.
So that's just my comment on that. I hate the trolls.
Agree. Yeah, it's awful. You know, but I mean, we could just, you know, if we could keep it real on this show, we could, you know, try to weed those idiots out.
Absolutely.
100%. Anything else you guys got on that one? Yeah. Or?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
All right, but that's a good question by Pilchy. So, good job there, Mike. I hope we answered. You know, I hope I answered it. Anything else you want me to add? Just let me know. So the next one's from Billy Raids, and he's got a couple good ones tonight. Yeah, he's got a real good one coming up. This one here, though, he says, Sean, could you tell the story about John Gotti and his neighbor? And is that true, or is that just a legend? No, it's a true story. I don't know if you guys know this, but it tells the viciousness of the mob. John Gotti, I want to say 1984, yeah, somewhere around 84, he had a son, Frank Gotti. He was only like 11, 12 years old, and he was riding a bike, and he was hit by a car driven by one of Gotti's neighbors, who was a friend of his, he lived right down the block, a guy by the name of John Favara, and the kid died.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and it was just an accident. The you know, Favara wasn't drinking, he wasn't speeding, but you know, the kid just came out, and there was a dumpster, and he was coming down an alley, and the car was coming down, and he didn't see him, and he flew out right behind the dumpster, and you know, he couldn't stop quick enough, and he just hit him and killed him. You know, so what ended up happening was, you know, Favara, you know, he was pleading to the family, you know, to forgive him and stuff, and you know, the wife, Gotti's wife, was really upset, and of course Gotti was. And so what ended happening was, the police went to Favara, and they said that they've been hearing that, you know, there's threats out against him, and you know, he should try to keep a lookout, and maybe even, you know, try to get some protection, because they've been hearing that Gotti's going to try, you know, retaliation. And what happened was, Gotti and his wife go on a trip to Florida, and then Favara disappears. And the witnesses said they seen him, a van pulled up, a couple guys came out, and there was an altercation. They grabbed Favara, and they threw him in the back of the van, and then he was never seen again. And the FBI said that there was an informant that they had that told them that, you know, Gotti's guys took Favara to a warehouse, they tortured him, and then they cut him up with a chainsaw. So that pretty much shows you the viciousness. Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yikes.
And you know what? And the thing is, it was an accident. It wasn't like, you know, he, like I said, if you want to blame somebody, probably the guy that put the dumpster there, you know. There was no, it was just a tragic accident. But
Jesus.
It goes to show you, you know, how vicious the mob is. And the thing is, the movie I raved about, the Gotti HBO movie, they put that in the movie. I don't know if you remember that, Matt, because you've seen the movie.
Yeah. Now that you're saying it, yep.
But the way they depicted the movie wasn't accurate. That was one problem I have with the movie. They made it like Gotti, you know, he told in the movie, Gotti tells Sammy DeBoo Gravano, you know, it was just an accident. Don't worry about it. Don't do anything. And then Gravano did it on his own, and he killed the guy.
Right.
He actually shot him. They showed him shooting him, and that's not how it happened. That's not how it happened. You know, there's like I said, there's an informant that said that Gotti ordered it. And, you know, and the guy disappeared. He was never, you know, he wasn't shot like he was in the movie.
Right, right.
That we know of, you know what I mean? So.
Yeah, some scenes they just, you know, they take it and it's just dramatized. They make it more, you know, I guess that's the word.
Yeah. Know? I mean, that shows you, you know, that shows you the viciousness of the mob, you know?
Right.
So that's that question. That, you know, that was good. Anything you want to add before I go on?
No, you can keep it rolling.
Okay, the next one, there's a couple here that's going to get me fired up. These next couple are really going to get
these
me.
These are going to be the best.
Yeah, these are, I'm going to try to keep it civil and, you know, we'll tone it down a little. But this one here, is this one's from John Raid.
I just got to mention, though, if you have to throw out some curse words, it's on Matt's dime. So remember, we're donating to the animal shelters in the area.
Feel free to express yourself.
Yeah, okay. I'll try to keep it civil, though. I will. So this is from John Raid. So he said, Sean, with all the changes taking place in the tearing down of statues, how do you feel about the people that are now saying that Notre Dame should change the Fighting Irish name and mascot because it's offensive? Now, this is just ridiculous. I mean, is this the point we're at in society where, you know, we're offending mythical creatures from Ireland? Like, I mean,
God.
To me, it's ridiculous. Like, the things you could change.
I didn't hear that.
Oh, yeah. There's idiots out there. And the thing is, if you understand the name, like look, I'm Irish and Polish and proud of it. And the thing is, that name, Fighting Irish, is a sense of pride. It's the Irish have been fighting for freedom from Britain over in Ireland for years. You know, the Irish, when they came over here, they fought in the mines. They were working hard in the mines. They fought their way up. So that name is a sense of pride. It's not offensive to anybody. And the thing is, I don't know if you guys know how the name came about, but in 1920, I believe it was 1920, they weren't called the Fighting Irish. But what happened was the Ku Klux Klan was having a rally in South Bend, Indiana, mm-hmm. and they were marching through the campus, and a lot of the football team blocked the Klan from marching, and a lot of the team at that time, they were Irish players and stuff. So a fight broke out, and the football team ended up winning. They backed the Klan down. The Klan ran for cover, and then the next day in the paper, there was a big headline, you know, Notre Dame's Fighting Irish backed down the Klan, and that's how they got the name, and then they adopted the name. So if that's offensive, if fighting the Ku Klux Klan is offensive to you, then I'm offended by you. You know what I mean? Like, it's just stupid. And the first person that I heard come out on this is Max Kellerman on ESPN. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that creature.
I know the name.
Well, here's the thing. He's got zero talent, you know, and he doesn't know anything about sports. And the other thing is, I'm offended by Max Kellerman because a few years ago he came out and admitted on ESPN, you know, that he beat his wife. And then he ended up getting like a week suspension or something stupid like that. And the thing is, you know what? If there was any justice, they would put Max Kellerman in the jail cell with Jimmy Coonan, Jimmy Burke, Frank Sheeran, and let's throw in Bugs Moran. And he could tell those guys how he's offended by the nickname Fighting Irish.
Right.
And see what happens to him. Because this is just stupid. If you want to change something, let's change the name of that airport in D.C. because every time I go there, I get disgusted that Dulles' name is on that airport. or J. Edgar Hoover, you know, name on a federal building. I mean, you want to change something that's offensive. You know what I mean?
For sure.
So, I don't know. You guys got anything to add to that?
Well, being a fighting Irish fan here.
Me too,
yep,
buddy.
I'm a diehard fan. So who proposed this? Was this a Penn State fan?
No, you know what? You never know. But it's just like, that was good. But it's just, like I said, Max Kellerman was the first one I heard. And then there was something online, people were going around, but it's mostly trolls. I don't think there's any teeth to it. The school hasn't even acknowledged it, and I can't see them ever changing that. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it may, you know, it's not offensive to anybody. Like I said, we're offending mystical creatures from Ireland. We're defending, you know, offending leprechauns. Like, are you kidding me? Like, come on.
I mean, I guess we should just get rid of the leprechaun on St. Patrick's Day then. I mean.
Yeah, I mean, what's next? You know what I mean? Like, let's change stuff that are really offensive. If they're offensive to somebody, I could see, but just change it for the sake of change and just, to me, makes no sense.
Yep.
Especially something like that should be a sense of pride. You know, fighting the Klan, the Irish plus the Fighting 69, which is a regiment of the New York Army,
right?
The military. I mean, that's, you know what I mean. Like, what are you going to do? Change that now? I mean, it's like that term "Fighting Irish" is a sense of pride. It's not offensive.
Yeah, but like you said, for over the years, I mean, you look at it. I mean, the name is established around a meaning of pride. It's not, isn't like a fighting group of Irishmen starting a bar brawl, you know?
No,
like,
no,
this
it's
is,
not.
This and, is, and, like you said, years of history you go back. The Irish were fighting and fighting and fighting their way to their top, you know?
Fighting Britain for independence, yes. Then they were fighting when they came over here, you know? And then, you know, it's just amazing. But, you know, when you get trolls like Max Kellerman, like, he just, how does creature has a job at ESPN? It just shows you ESPN isn't about sports anymore. Yep. It's sports entertainment. They don't care about anything
else. I think if you were...
They like shock value.
Well, I was going to say, I think if you really want to get down to it and you really want to kind of explain this, look at it this way. In both the upraise, like the fist of, because it's the leprechaun holding up his fist. So the I get that with the mascot, and then the use of the word fighting. To me, that intent is just to recognize determination. That's it. Like every other sports team that goes out there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not fighting physically. They're fighting to win their game. They're fighting to win the competition of athleticism here, you know?
Yeah. It's really like I said, it's like stupid.
Yeah.
It's
I think
really
the
end, stupid.
Yep.
It doesn't make any sense.
So I totally agree with you. Shame on them.
Yeah. Well, Max Kellerman, and the thing is, Max Kellerman is Jewish, too. So, I mean, you know, he should know the history behind it, that they were fighting the Klan. You know what I mean? Like, that to him should not be offensive.
Yeah.
You know, but again, Max Kellerman's job is just to shock value. He's just to say stuff to you know, get a response. That's what he does.
I just only wish I had the time and energy to get upset about a mythical creature, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't.
Oh, I'll tell you. It's unbelievable.
Okay.
And then anything else? Because the next one's going to even infuriate me even more.
No, you just keep rolling.
Okay. Well, okay. This next one is just unbelievable. This is from Richie. He says, Sean, I think... Wait, let me read this. He says, I think J. Edgar Hoover was a good FBI director. He said, why are you so negative on him? I like your podcasts and enjoy listening to them when you're on, but feel you are biased against certain people like Hoover and Dulles. I mean, okay, yeah, maybe I am a little biased.
I can just hear the smile.
Well, okay, I don't want the directors of our government agencies to kill American citizens. So, yeah, okay, I am a little biased. You know, what is J. Edgar Hoover? How do you say J. Edgar Hoover's a good director? Well, the thing is, what is he a good director? Because he was saving the world from my mom and grandma being able to vote? Because he thought that women's right to vote was a national security threat? I mean, where was he a good director? We have evidence now he was involved in Martin Luther King's assassination. He was involved in Freddie Hampton's assassination, the head of the Chicago chapter of Black Panthers. He covered up the JFK assassination. he covered up the RFK assassination, because you remember that that guy John Meyer went to him with information that Robert Mayhew was behind it, and he says he knew it was Robert Mayhew and the CIA, but he can't do anything about him, so he covered it up. And then there's information now that he also covered up the another Dulles assassination of Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the UN, mm-hmm. and Hoover covered that up. So, I mean, how is he a good director? He's covering up assassinations. He's involved in some assassinations directly. He's targeting people that are not a national security threat. In you know, he's going against their rights. He's legally wiretapping people.
Right.
I mean, how in the world could you say he's a good director? And the same thing with Dulles. Like I said, get his name off that airport and get Hoover's name off the federal building if you want to change something. But I don't understand the question. Maybe Rich could send an email back and say why he thinks Hoover's a good director, because I would love to hear that one.
Yeah, that's definitely not a guy that I would put on my list and, you know, elaborate on such a great... I mean, I can't. I'm actually kind of shocked because, like, that's one name I would never expect. You know?
Well, the other thing is, you know, groups that Hoover should have been targeting, like the mob and the KKK, yeah. were off limits. He didn't want to target them. He didn't want to go after those groups.
I mean, anybody knows that if you search and you go and you dig deep into J. Edgar Hoover, guy had a lot of skeletons. And the big thing that circles around his name is the C word, controversy. There's way too much controversy surrounding that guy's name. And I totally agree. I mean, take him off the federal building. Yeah, I don't think we should be praised. I think, you know what, I would definitely commend, and I would definitely love to see maybe a veteran's name on a federal building instead of that.
Well, sure. Well, you know? Like I said, if you're going to put, you know, an FBI building, you know, if you want to put somebody's name on there, how about Joe Pistone, who I mentioned before was undercover in the mafia? There's an FBI hero.
Yeah.
You want to put an FBI hero on the building, put his name on the building. Why are you going to put Hoover's name on the building?
Yep.
I mean, all the documentation we have on this guy, I mean, I don't know. I really would like to hear Rich, if he could send an email back and, you know, let me know where he thinks Hoover was a great director. That'll be interesting.
Does Nixon have his name on any buildings these days?
I know there's a Nixon library, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a Nixon library. That's
I'm just asking. Just asking.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that's you know, glorified and stuff. Like I said, Dulles Airport. I mean, and that's actually for Dulles's brother, John Foster Dulles.
Yeah.
You know, but still, I mean, John Foster was almost as bad as Allen. So I mean, but yeah, I don't know. I just don't get it. But I guess, you know. I'd like to hear the reasons. If he could, Rich could send in the reasons, because, you know, that would be interesting.
Yeah, I'd actually like to hear that. Like, I'd actually like to see, like, what some of the reasoning is that, like, I'm not saying he probably praises him, but, like, what makes him stand out that he's such a good candidate, a very good person to commend, you know?
Well, the only thing I could think of is, you know, for years, you know, even, like, if you go back to the days when Hoover was active as FBI director, I mean, he was praising the media. I mean, he wasn't, you know, none of this came out about him. He was a revered figure. I mean, he was, you know, he was glorified a lot through the media and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and even after he died and stuff, and even after, you know, that, I mean, he was still glorified for quite a while until stuff started coming out about the things he was doing.
Right.
And like I said, the whole COINTELPRO thing, if those activists didn't break into the FBI building in Media, Pennsylvania, we wouldn't even known about that COINTELPRO program, which was all illegal wiretaps, illegal surveillance. The whole thing was illegal. You know, we wouldn't even known about
that.
You know, so, I mean, I don't know. I'd like to hear the answer.
Ditto.
Okay, let's move on. So, next one is from my buddy Hallie up in Boston. He's actually from Quincy, Mass. And Quincy's got a lot of history there with Whitey Bulger. He had a lot of, you know, activity at that way. So here's Hallie's question. He said, Sean, my Irish brother, he said, could you tell me about any connection between President Bush and Whitey Bulger's brother, Senator William Bulger? And was Whitey Bulger part of the CIA MK Ultra program? Because I heard he was. So these are two good questions. So first one, there is a connection between President Bush and William Bulger, Senator Bulger. They were really close, even though Bush was a Republican and Bulger was a Democrat. And the thing is, there's a thing on YouTube, a St. Patrick's Day from, I want to say, like when Bush was running for president, like 88, he was running against Dukakis. And he used to have this St. Patrick's Day every year. And Bush and Bulger was there, and all politicians would come from all over, and they would kiss up to Bulger because he was powerful. He was the most powerful state at the state level in Massachusetts, there's no doubt. But he had power with the federal level, too. And Bush called in at this party, you know, at the St. Patrick's Day dinner. And they're making jokes, they're laughing, and Bush actually makes a joke about Iran-Contra, which was still being investigated back then. And I'm sure you guys are familiar with Iran-Contra.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't want to go into that, but, I mean, Bush and Reagan, they should have been in jail for that. I mean, Oliver North took the, you know, he fell on the sword with that. But here's Bush, and they're joking about it. And I forget what he actually said, but he said something to William Bulger. He said, you know, we're gonna make a bill, and we're going to need you to get it through, and we're going to run some guns over to the Contras. And Bulger's, like, laughing about it. He's like, yeah, I'll have my buddy McNeely. He says he'll write it up, and we'll push it through, and we'll get it. And here's these guys. I mean, this is how open they are. Like, they're making a joke about Iran-Contra. Like, are you kidding me? You know, and you can look that up. I don't know if it's still, but if it's still on there, but it was on YouTube, and it was a St. Patrick's Day dinner from 1988. And it's just an amazing piece of, yeah, like, they're just, you know, it's just a joke to Bush, you know? And I remember, Matt, you asked me a question about Bush one time, didn't you, Bob?
Yeah, I actually...
You thought he was involved in the Kennedy assassination
yep.
and stuff?
Well, that's why I brought that up, like what you were just explaining before, because I was trying to link that up to it. But yeah, I do remember actually... I forget how the conversation even started, but I swore there was a tie-in there. And I had to ask you, was Bush involved?
Yeah, you were asking me about Felix Rodriguez. Remember you mentioned Felix Rodriguez?
Yep.
Well, he was a CIA guy that was real close to Bush. And see, here's the thing. I don't see the evidence that Bush was involved directly in the assassination. But Bush was, remember, Bush after the whole Watergate scandal, Bush became CIA director. And Bush was also, his father, Prescott, was partners with David Rockefeller and Alan Dulles.
Yeah.
So he was right in the mix of this. And you got to remember, when Bush was CIA director, there was a lot of shenanigans going on. When the House Select Committee on Assassinations was going on, all them bodies were dropping. Remember, like, George de Morenschild, he gets killed. Gaetan Fonzie's going around. He's handing his card to people and then turn around and they'll commit suicide or they die in some kind of freak car accident. And that's all on Bush's watch. So, I mean, I don't think, like, especially de Morenschild. De Morenschild, before he died, when Gaetan Fonzie gives that card to de Morenschild's daughter, and then de Morenschild comes back and the daughter gives the card to him, and he goes, the first call he makes is to George Bush. And then the next thing you know, de Morenschild is dead. They said it was a suicide, but there's a lot of evidence that that was not a suicide.
Right.
So, you know, and I'm not – and George Bush was very close to Richard Helms, so I don't think it's a stretch to say that Bush – when de Morenschild contacts Bush, you know, I don't think it's a stretch to say that Bush might have reached out to Richard Helms and said, hey, you better clean this mess up because this guy's, you know, might be talking to the committee. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of dirt on Bush, and you know, even like the Reagan assassination. I mean, I think, is it a coincidence that Hinckley was really good friends with the Bush family?
It's a coincidence.
I mean, you know, it's just, and then, you know, Hinckley was involved in a company that, you know, was the MK Ultra was running out of. So, I mean, there's just a lot on Bush. And, of course, you know, we know that Whitey Bulger was, you know, active, the FBI was protecting him. But there's a lot of hits that Bulger did, like that, you know, they seem like outside the organized crime hits, like the one when he killed that Roger Wheeler, that billionaire from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Like, that to me has all the earmakes of a deep state hit, because I even read stuff where Roger Wheeler was connected to guys that were in Iran-Contra. So was somebody afraid at a high level? Because that hit required a lot of... you know, inside knowledge. Like, Wheeler was protected by ex-Secret Service, ex-FBI guys. I mean, somebody gave the Bulger's guys the layout of the country club out there, and you know, and his protection was taken away. So that to me looks like a deep state hit. So there was definitely a connection there between Bush and Bulger. And then the second part, we know Whitey Bulger was an active member of MKUltra. That's a fact. Even though, you know, the files were destroyed, we do know that, you know, there was a prison program where the CIA was looking for volunteers. And, of course, some of them, they when they couldn't get enough volunteers, they did people that weren't volunteered, and they used them in the thing, too. But they were, if you signed up for the program, and they were experimenting with LSD and other stuff, you would get like an early release. So Bulger was in Alcatraz at the time for bank robbery. And the interesting thing is that, you know, up to that point, Whitey Bulger didn't really have a lot of violence, especially murder. He had no murders on his resume up to that point. And when he gets out, I mean, you know, you know what happened. I mean, his body's everywhere. There's graveyards up there, you know. I don't know how many hits they said he ordered, or, you know, I think it's over 30 now, maybe more, you know. So was that, and Bulger did tell, he kind of used that as defense. He told his lawyer that, you know, that program gave him massive headaches and caused him anger and stuff, and that's why he became so violent. So who knows if that's true, you know?
For sure.
So anything else you want to add on that one?
I'm good.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
So that's some good questions there from Hallie. Keep them coming. I hope I answered them there. The next one is, this is from Billy Raids, and this is a great one. This would, if I want to do justice with this answer, it would probably take the whole show. So I'm going to try to keep it, you know, as condensed as I can. So here it is. Sean, this is a big question. Do you think the assassinations did the job that was intended by the government? In other words, there are no real civil rights leaders anymore. We have lots of groups and people who are vocal, but no more Kennedys or Kings. Jesse Jackson has been kind of marginalized, and Sharpton is kind of a joke. Do you think those assassinations scared people to stay quiet or make them seek out groups instead of being a focal point? Wow, that's a great question. That's an excellent question. So there's a lot to unpack there. So, you know, we talked about this before, you know, that yeah, I do think those assassinations were intended to do that, because I told you there's a line that everybody knows not to cross, you know, and we talk about the tack that was on the left, but not just the assassinations, but the COINTELPRO program, the Operation Chaos. They were trying to eradicate the left wing, the Democratic Party, which at the time was called the New Left. And I had this argument with my brother because he didn't agree with me, but I think they were successful. I think they did eradicate that left wing. Because if you look at the left wing of the Democratic Party today, it does not look anything like it did in the 60s. And I know there's, you know, you're talking about a big time period. I'm just saying about the stuff that the people like Bobby Kennedy, John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, the stuff that those guys were trying to do, nobody attempts to do that anymore, because they know there's that line and they can't cross it. Like, I'm sure you guys heard the people say, like, you know, I didn't leave the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left me. Well, I don't think it left them. I think it was eradicated by guys like Hoover and Dulles. And you know, that was their plan, to get rid of that. And I think, like, I heard a comedian one time, I forget which comedian, but he made a joke about, you know, when a new president is, you know, sworn in and stuff, they take him to an island, and then they show him a picture, a video of the Zapruder film and the Kennedy assassination, and then they show the real shooter at the grassy knoll, and then they say, any questions? Now, you know, it's a joke. I don't think it's that dramatic, but I think, you know, people, you know, they know when they're in that power, you know, the line is there, because you see the evidence. You know this isn't a lone gunman. You know all the evidence telling you it's not a lone gunman. So you know there's a power behind it. And you know that there's certain things that you can't cross and certain lines you can't cross. So, I do believe that. And to talk about, you know, Bill's question specifically was about civil rights. I do believe that, you know, they definitely try to marginalize. They wanted people in there that they could control. And, you know, there's a lot of information on Jesse Jackson, you know, possibly even being an FBI informant at the time, which, because he was close to that guy we mentioned in the MLK episode, Malcolm McCullough, you know, and he was an undercover intelligence operative.
Yeah.
And he was one of the guys that set King up. So I think, you know, they want people in there that they could work with. They don't, because, again, there's a line they could cross, and there's a line you can't cross. And, you know, I'll tell you another story. When Obama got in, I listened to Black Op Radio, and they had a guy in there, I forget who it was, but he was friends with an aide in Obama's cabinet, high up. And he said that he told him that at the end of Obama's second term, he was sitting with the president. And, you know, when Obama came in, he was all about hope and change. And they were going to do all these things. And realistically, they didn't attempt to do a lot of them. And, you know, he says, Mr. President, what happened to all that hope and change that we were going to do? And Obama looks at him and he said, well, you saw what they did to Dr. King, didn't you? So these guys know. Everybody knows, you know. This is why nobody goes after the Federal Reserve. This is why, you know, JFK's foreign policy is so different than everybody else. Like, nobody, like, Kennedy wanted nothing to do with Saudi Arabia. You know what I mean? I mean, his foreign policy was the opposite of what everybody else's foreign policy is. So, yeah, I do think, I think, you know, definitely those assassinations were, you know, intended to do what they did. You know, which was marginalize certain groups. You know, and I think you could even go to internationally, because, you know, you look at the other assassinations that they were behind, you know, people like Dulles. I mean, with Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, and Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the UN, yeah. R. Benz in Guatemala, you know. So, I mean, that's a deep question there, and there's a lot to that, but I totally agree that I think that was the tenth of the conspirators. You know, I think the long-term effects of that is they were going to put people in the positions that could be controlled. So I don't know if you guys, you know, and I, you know, my brother doesn't think, you know, he doesn't really agree with me on the eradication of the left wing of the Democratic Party. But, I mean, I think if you look at the party today compared to what it was in the 60s, it's much different.
Yeah, for sure it is.
And I think that was the intent. So that's just a great question by Billy Raids, you know. Really deep, and that's, you know. I don't know, you guys got anything else to add to that?
I'm good.
Well, the next one is from my brother Jamie. And he says, Sean, do you think McGeorge Bundy was involved in the conspiracy to assassinate JFK? And is there any new information on the conspiracy from the declassified documents? Oh, okay, so this is a good one. So, okay, the first part of that question, McGeorge Bundy. So McGeorge Bundy was Kennedy's national security advisor.
Uh-huh.
I don't, there's not enough evidence. Like, there's so much evidence against Dulles, James Angleton, David Atlee Phillips. There's not that type of evidence against McGeorge Bundy. But my gut feeling is that I think for the conspirators to be successful with the assassination, they needed somebody in the Pentagon, which would have been Curtis LeMay. They needed somebody in the military, which would have been General Ed Lansdale. And they also needed somebody, they needed a Judas in Kennedy's administration to really pull this off. And the two suspects would have been either Dean Rusk, who had a lot of intelligence background, or McGeorge Bundy. And McGeorge Bundy was extremely close to Alan Dulles. His brother Bill Bundy was a CIA guy. And when Senator Joe McCarthy and the whole Red Scare thing went after Bill Bundy because he was saying he was a communist, Dulles stepped in and threatened McCarthy. You know, he tried to blackmail him and got him to back off his brother. So, you know, he was in debt to Dulles, and they were real close. So, and there was some suspicious things, Bundy. I mean, Bundy was on Air Force One because most of the cabinet was over in Hawaii at the time. And you know, Bundy was the one that said to the rest of the people on that plane that a lone gunman was caught, and that was it. And this was like, you know, less than an hour after the assassination, he's the first guy, he's announcing this, that it's a lone gunman. Like, the investigation is not even underway, and he's, you know, he's saying, so there's some suspicion there, but, I mean, you know, I can't say for fact, but that would be my gut, you know, that the conspirators needed somebody inside the administration, and he would be the Judas, you know. And the second part of that question, is there any new information? Yeah, there's a ton of new information. So there's this researcher, Malcolm Blunt. He's, I think he's a retired psychiatrist from England. And you probably never heard of him because he doesn't write any books or nothing. He does research. He reads all the declassified documents, and then he helps other researchers do their book, you know. But he became friends with a guy by the name of Pete Bagley. Now, Pete Bagley was a CIA guy, high ranking CIA guy. And he was actually the chief of counterintelligence for the Soviet Russian division. So he would have been right under in the chain of command. He would have been under guys like Dulles, Angleton, Phillips. And one day they became really good friends, and they were going over documents, and he was showing them stuff. And Bagley said to him one day, he said to Malcolm Blunt, he said, "We're going over all this stuff on Oswald." And he says, "Looking at all this information, do you think Oswald was unwitting or witting participant in the intelligence here?" And Malcolm Blunt's looking at this, and he's like, "I don't know." He says, "You're the CIA guy. I don't know." He says, "Well, give me an answer." He says, "Well, was he unwitting or witting?" And he said, Malcolm Blunt said, "Well, if you're going to, you know, you want an answer from me, I guess I'm going to say unwitting." And then Pete Bagley said, "No, he had to be witting. He had to be a known asset on a mission for the CIA," and then explain to him why. So the importance to this is the first time, to my knowledge, that a high-ranking CIA official admitted that Lee Harvey Oswald was on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. So that's key to the entire conspiracy because, you know, they set him up. They set him up in Mexico City, and they set him up afterwards. So that's explosive information that should have been blasted all over the, you know, the mainstream media, but of course it never was, you know. So, and there's a lot of other new information coming out, but again, it's like we're pressed for time here to get into all of it, but yeah. That's a good question there by Jamie. So the next one is from Frank. And he says, "Sean, is there any new information on JFK in Vietnam?" Well, I mean, I really think the whole Vietnam, the Kennedy Vietnam thing, I think we could put this to bed, that Kennedy was pulling out. There's no doubt about that now. But one of the things that, you know, Fletcher Prouty, who was the focal officer between the CIA and the military and the Pentagon, you know, he explained the situation about the advisors, because there's always this thing that Kennedy tried to escalate the war by putting advisors there. But the truth is, remember, there was zero combat troops the day Kennedy took office, and there was zero there the day he died. The advisors, though, were originally put there by Nixon and President Eisenhower. And they put, I believe originally they put like 5,000 there. And then there's another 10,000 troops, or not troops, but advisors that are credited to Kennedy putting there. But see, people don't understand, the logistics of these things are not done by the president. They're done by the military. So when Eisenhower and Nixon put those advisors in Vietnam, they also put another 10,000 advisors in areas around there, like Thailand and Panama and even like South Korea. And then when Kennedy became president, the generals in the military moved as advisors over to Vietnam. So that's where everybody said, well, Kennedy put 10,000 advisors into Vietnam. Well, no, they were already in the region, and the military moved them into Vietnam after the fact. You know what I'm saying? So to say that Kennedy put them there to escalate the war is just ridiculous. And again, an advisor is advising the resistance, the South Vietnam resistance. They're not combat troops. Johnson was the one that ended up putting 500,000 combat troops there. You know, and the other information that we have now is that, you know, we have a transcript of a phone call between Lyndon Johnson when he was president, Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense. And on this tape, Johnson says something to the effect that, he says to McNamara, you know, when you guys were talking about withdrawing from Vietnam and coming up with your plan, he said, I sat there quiet because I respected what you guys were doing. I know what you guys, Kennedy wanted to pull out, but I thought it was wrong. He says, I thought we should have been escalating and not pulling out. So right there is evidence that, you know, Johnson knew what Kennedy was going to do because, you know, Lyon Lyndon later on said that he was just following JFK's policy, which he wasn't, you know. So that's evidence there that Johnson knew Kennedy was pulling out. And, you know, he says he stayed quiet, but then when he became president, you know, he escalated it. So I think finally we could put that Vietnam thing to bed. There was no way Kennedy was escalating that war. I just think we covered that enough. So the next question. This one is from Larry. And he says, Sean, could you explain how JFK went against the Federal Reserve? I heard economists say that he didn't. Well, I mean, if you listen to economists, I mean, you know, they're going to talk for an hour. You're not going to know what the hell they're talking about. And then they're just going to say at the end, well, you know, Kennedy really didn't go against the Federal Reserve. And it's just ridiculous. I mean, if you got to read the book, anybody who's interested, Battling Wall Street by Donald Gibson. And it's all on Kennedy's presidency, okay? And the whole thing tells you. You know, you understand how Kennedy was up against it. He wanted to take the power away from the Federal Reserve, and what he wanted to do was give it to the Comptroller of Commerce, which was a guy by the name of James Sangson, the Comptroller of the Currency, and that would have took the power away from the Fed. You know, because, and again, Kennedy was also printing his own money, you know, from the Treasury Department. You know, so all this stuff, like, and when you read the book, you really get a sense of how, you know, Rockefeller, how he was so up against Rockefeller and Dulles and these guys in his economic plan, you know. And the thing is, all these guys, like the 1%, Rockefeller, Rothschild, they all listened to this philosopher from the 1600s, a guy by the name of Thomas Malthus. And his whole idea was stuff that, like, poverty, famine, war, homelessness, that it's all necessary for population control, if you can believe that. And that's what these guys, you know, believe in. So they have these organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations, the IMF, the Trilateral Commission. All this stuff is designed to keep the power with the 1%, you know. And Kennedy was more like Alexander Hamilton than he was, you know, anybody else. I mean, a lot of his policies were similar to what, you know, Hamilton's ideas, even though you're talking about way different eras, they're still similar in ideas, you know. So, you know, but given the power to the control of the currency would have taken a lot of the power away from the Fed, because they control interest rates, they control the whole banking system. And, you know, it's interesting, when after Kennedy was killed, James Sangson kind of got, you know, marginalized himself. And Johnson put him in, like, a basement office somewhere and everything, and he really didn't have much say in anything else, you know. So that's that definitely, there's no doubt he went against the Fed. So I hope that answers that question. Let's see. I'm really taking too much time on some of these questions.
That's okay. You can always come back and do another one.
Yeah, we're not going to get through. I'm not even halfway through. What we have? Where are we time-wise, Jen?
Let's see. We've got about 15 minutes left.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. The next one is from Andrew. He says, Sean, how did Russell Bufalino react to John Gotti taking out Castellano? Do you have any information on this, or even an opinion? Well. There's not a lot of documentation of what Bufalino was thinking, but I could tell you, when Gotti did this hit on Castellano, that was December 85. Bufalino was really towards the end of his life. Like, his health was not good. He was under indictment, I believe, Frankie Sheeran, his right hand, the Irishman, his health was not good. And Buffalino had given a lot of his power. He started a transition, one of his guys, Billy D'Elia, to take over the family. So I don't think Buffalino was in any position to really do anything about it, but I'm sure he wasn't happy with it because, you know, Gotti wouldn't get, he broke all the rules. He didn't get a commission okay, and Buffalino was close to Castellano, but he was also close to Gotti's mentor, Neely Della Croce. So I don't know if, you know, he ever met Gotti. I don't know if Buffalino and Gotti were ever in the same room together. I don't know, but my gut feeling would be that he wasn't happy with it, but there really wasn't much he could do because his health was not good. And I would say the same thing with Tony Accardo in Chicago. I don't think he would have been happy with the hit either, but his health wasn't good, you know. And I think Accardo ended up dying in 92, and I think Buffalino ended up dying in 94. But, you know, by 85, their health was not good, and they didn't have the power that they once had. So that would be my gut feeling on that one.
Okay.
Let's see. Oh, this is an interesting one. So this is from my brother again, Jamie. He said, Sean, is there any truth to the story of the attempted assassination on Jimmy Carter by two guys whose names sound like Lee Harvey Oswald? I don't know if you guys ever heard this story, but it is true. Carter, when he came in, he was looking into the Kennedy assassination, actually. He had his people looking into it. And then what happened was there was two guys that were arrested in a plot to kill Carter. And their names were, if you could believe this, their names were Raymond Lee Harvey and Oswaldo Esposito. So when you put them together, you got Lee Harvey Oswaldo. You know, and on the surface, it looks like it's a message job being sent to Carter, you know, back off what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And he did. He did. So, you know, who knows, you know, if that's just some crazy coincidence. But, you know, the CIA does stuff like that. Like, that would be typical of what they would do. And the thing is, the interesting thing about Carter is he also, you know, for a left-wing Democrat, two of his closest advisors after that was Nelson Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger, who was, you know, David's guys, obviously. And they, you know, and he was also, Carter joined the Trilateral Commission, which was a Rockefeller creation shortly after that. So, you know, who knows if that was a message job and Carter got the message, I guess. So that's a good question.
That was a good one.
Yeah, and it's just crazy that the name, I mean, when you see them in print, and you see the name together, and you see Raymond Lee Harvey and Oswaldo Esposito, and then you just see Lee Harvey Oswald just staring at you. You know what I mean? It's just crazy. So the next one's from Kevin. He says, Sean, why did J. Edgar Hoover and Lyndon Johnson go with the lone gunman theory when Dulles and Angleton were blaming it on the Cubans and the Russians? Well, that's a good question. Well, we talked about this. With Mexico City, you know, Hoover and Johnson, the documentation's there that they knew that the Mexico City thing was a CIA scam. They know that Oswald wasn't there because they had the tapes. And Hoover's on record saying the tapes of the guy that impersonated Oswald in Mexico City don't match, the voice recognition don't match the guy that they have in custody. You know, so right there, Hoover and Johnson have a choice. They have three choices. They could accept that and then go after the Cubans and the Russians and basically start a nuclear war, World War III. But Johnson panicked and he didn't want to do that. That's where he says, we got to take this out of the realm of a communist conspiracy. And then Hoover says, well, we need to convince the public that Lee Harvey Oswald is the lone gunman. And their other option would have been they know that the CIA is, you know, bullshitting them with this Mexico City thing. So it would have been, go after the CIA, you know. But the thing is, you know, we talked about this. There's no way Hoover Johnson's going to go after Dulles and the CIA. So his other option is the lone gunman, and that's the option he went with. So anything you guys want to add on that?
No, I'm good.
Let me see. Okay, so I got a couple questions. My buddy Scott Hopkins, He asked me, Sean, he said, do you have any information that the deep state was involved in the deaths of John Lennon or Jimi Hendrix? Now, that's really good. That's a good one. But no, I don't. I mean, I haven't looked into those. I just don't have time to look into everything. But my gut feeling is like with John Lennon, I know Lennon was heavily involved in activism with anti-war movement. I know he was heavily involved in Northern Ireland, back in the Irish civil rights over there. And I know the MI5 was after him. I know the FBI COINTELPRO program was after Lennon. But my question would be, you know, when was Lennon assassinated? Was it like 1981, something like that? Like why would he be assassinated then and not 71? When he was really, you know, at the heart of his activism. So that would be my question. Like, not everything is a deep state conspiracy. You know, it's just, if he was assassinated in 71, then I would be a little bit more suspicious. As far as Jimi Hendrix, I mean, I know there's a lot of suspicion around that murder. I got to look into it. And I know Hendrix was an activist too, but there was also a lot of people that were more active, you know, like a guy like Pete Seeger, a musician that was really active, the anti-war movement and stuff like that. So why they would choose to take out Hendrix instead of somebody like Pete Seeger, I don't know. You know what I mean? So I don't have an answer on that. So that I'm going to have to look into more. But those are good questions.
Okay.
So this one actually is kind of more directed towards you guys. Hopkins says, it's from Scott Hopkins again. He said, Sean, why did Matt and Jenna reference Once Upon a Time in Hollywood during the Manson podcast? It was a good movie, but it was pure fiction. There was no relevance to the rest of the podcast.
Because we're a pop culture podcast.
Yeah, I think that's the simple answer to it. You know, we go into it just because of referencing. I mean, Manson, listen, there has been Manson references in there. I mean, just look at the end of the film. Yes, it didn't go down that way, but I mean, it's, you got to remember, it's based on information used. It's not based on true events, because it's not telling the documentary, it's not telling the full story. But like we said, you know, it's a pop culture reference. It's a pop culture entity. That's probably one of the latest and maybe the last things that we've seen Manson referenced in, like big film or big documentary that was released, you know?
Right.
So
yeah, you have to remember, like, it's a Tarantino film. So exactly. His missions is to, like, choose, like, alternate realities. So, like, I don't know. I thought it was a good film, and I thought it was fitting to talk about because we are a pop culture podcast. And
well, he agrees it was a good film. Yeah. He said in there he agreed it was, I don't know, I haven't seen
it. Yeah, we no way, shape, or form support it and say, okay, listen, what was it?
It's
fabricated, but it's an interesting topic just because of the pop culture reference.
Yeah.
And just, you know, like some of the feedback I got at Manson, like it seems like it's kind of like a good split between, you know, some people agree with Jenna, some people agree with me on, you know, our debate basically on the Manson. But you got to realize we're coming at this from two totally different perspectives. I mean, Jenna's coming at it from forensics and, you know, psychology basically, and I'm coming at it from intelligence operations, black operations, and, you know, I guess a minor and organized crime is where my expertise is, you know, so we're just coming at it from two totally different angles.
And I still say, I mean, going back to that episode, man, it was a very good exchange of back and forth because again, there's some details in there that you know, obviously we're waiting to hear this side of it and that side of it. Like there's a bunch of stuff in there for that episode, Sean, that I didn't even know about.
Well, here's one thing I want to run past Jen. I wonder if this is a swear a little bit. I did a little bit more of a deep dive in Operation Chaos. Sharon Tate and Abigail Folger, two of the victims that night, both of them were named in Operation Chaos. They were major targets of that operation. So does that make you a little suspicious?
No.
Okay.
No.
I mean, to me, that makes my radar even go up more. I mean...
Yeah, the needle definitely just, it spiked for me.
I mean, you know? I knew they were targeting, I knew that Operation Chaos was targeting a lot of people at that house. I knew, like, Cass Elliott that hung out there, but, you know, then when the two victims that night, I mean, they were targets of that, you know, I don't know. That just, to me, like I said, it's just very suspicious. And it ties into Bill's whole question, you know, like with Operation Chaos, COINTELPRO, and the assassinations of the 60s, they were designed to basically destroy the left wing. And I have no doubt about that, you know. So where are we at right now on time? Because we got to be pretty close, right?
Yeah. I think that's going to have to wrap us up for this episode.
Okay.
Which we can definitely come back and, you know.
Well, one thing I want to, Hopkins asked me, you know, he wants me to do something on 9/11. And, you know, there's some questions I had on 9/11. And I'd have to look more into 9/11 before I could do anything because I haven't researched it that much. You know, and again, it's only 20 years. And when I say 20 years, like most of this documentation, you know, we're talking 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so it'll be another 10 years before any, you know, the credible information comes out about, you know, what happened in 9/11.
You know, I thought about that too. Yeah. I would have liked to do a 9/11 special, you know, especially since we're commemorating 20 years of it, you know, this year. So we just obviously, we went past that date, but yeah, maybe we could get something come back on 9/11 for sure.
Well, there's a lot of good questions here. There's a lot I didn't get to, so we'll have to get to them, you know, next time. And Nate still got his bunch of questions, and he's doing some research there. I think it was pretty good. A lot of smart listeners. Boy, they asked a lot of good questions, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they were through all the podcasts, you know? It covered, like, all the podcasts.
And we'll definitely have another session to come back on so that we could go back to those other ones that you have. And, of course, you know, we want to bring Nate the Great back on.
Yeah, definitely. Sure. Definitely. He really enjoyed it.
All right.
So that's about it then.
All right. Jen, do you have anything else to conclude? Or?
No, I'm good if you want to
wrap us up. I'll take us out of here. So everybody, thank you for stopping in tonight and listening. Make sure if you have any other questions that you want to feed us, you could always send those over to garlicjarmedia@gmail.com. We are on Facebook, so give us a like if you have a couple minutes there. Check us out. We do still post our episodes on Twitter under @DDoldrums and JRiley1411. We'll be back next week with another pop culture current events episode. We have been kind of getting some details. We've been following what's been going on with the Gabby Petito case. So we definitely would like to shed some light on that topic. Right, Jen? I think we'll probably go into that next episode. But for right now, stick with us. We'll be back next week with a new one, and we'll see ya. With a high class, a piccolo, and a cane.